And Gloriana Musical Theater hosts a black and white ball on New Year's Eve at Eagles Hall Theater in Fort Bragg. Doors at 8 p.m., music at 9 p.m. Jewels of Renewal, a New Year's Day self-care workshop with Julie Landis at Yoga Mendocino starts at 10 a.m. in Ukiah. And there's a new location for the Willits Homebrew Club's monthly meeting. They now meet the first Friday of each month at the KOA in Willits at 1600 Highway 20 for anyone 21 or over interested in making beer, wine, cider, mead, or anything fermented on Friday at 7 p.m. Please submit your public service announcement at least 2 weeks in advance. And check out our complete events calendar at kzyx.org.
This is KZYX, 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, also 88.1 Fort Bragg, and we stream on the web at kzyx.org. It's the last Tuesday of 2015, and this evening on the Ecology Hour, Don Lipmanson, former KZYX talk show host many years ago, also former Mendocino County Planning Commissioner from 2000 to 2006, is going to be our guest host this evening. And support for the Ecology Hour tonight comes from our members and from the Mendocino Solar Service, license 536983, reminding listeners that new residential solar installations are eligible for a federal tax credit under a program expiring in 2016. More information at mendocinosolar.com or 937-1701. Additional support comes from the Hazmobile, which reminds everyone that used oil filters are among the hazardous waste items that can be recycled at many auto parts stores and along with your other toxic waste items at the Hazmobile collections. The Hazmobile schedule is available at mendorecycle.org.
Good evening, listeners. It's a pleasure to be back on the air after quite a few years. And tonight, I'm hosting this show because 3 weeks ago, I think it was, the Ecology Hour had an interesting program about predator control in a non-lethal, non-killing sort of a way, where two people from the Hopland Field Station had a detailed discussion about non-lethal methods of predator control. But listening to that, it dawned on me that what wasn't being discussed was a very controversial politics underlying the question of predator livestock management, particularly in situations where there are conflicts between native predators like mountain lions, coyotes, bobcats, and bears, and sheep or cattle or goats that are being raised for livestock. And I also thought it would be really good if we could have a call-in segment, which there wasn't time for 3 weeks ago, because there are lots of different points of view about what's right and what's wrong in terms of how predators are dealt with in Mendocino County. And there's been a lot of talk about how Federal Wildlife Services, which is a division of the USDA, Department of Agriculture, generally, despite a lot of talk about being interested in non-lethal predator control, has a contract. The county has a contract with Wildlife Services, and the person, the trapper who deals with these things as an employee of Wildlife Services, has become a very controversial figure. I'm going to have two guests tonight, one of whom is Kelly Hendricks. She's Project Coyote's predator-friendly ranching coordinator. Kelly, who will talk a bit about herself as well, lives on a 500-acre ranch with her husband. Kelly's a former professional horse trainer and now volunteers at Sonoma Wildlife Rescue and rehabilitates horses for the Sonoma County Sonoma Change Program. Kelly, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi. I'm also then now going to introduce our other guest, Dr. Rick Hopkins, and I'll ask each of you two to talk a little bit more about yourselves before we get into the conversation. Rick Hopkins is a senior conservation biologist. He also serves on the Project Coyote Science Advisory Board, Rick runs the Live Oak Associates, which offers science-based solutions to natural resource issues. He has a PhD from Cal in wildlife ecology and has spent 35 years studying mammalian carnivores. Rick, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Don.
Great, thank you. I'm going to just make one or two more comments, and I'll ask both you and Kelly to introduce, to give a little bit more detail about your who you are and why you're involved in this issue. I wanted to say that I also invited Carrie Brown, First District Supervisor, to appear on this program because I've known Carrie from days on the Planning Commission, and she's a very articulate and thoughtful proponent of back then she was the director of the local Farm Bureau, and she spoke, I've heard her speak often, and we often disagree, but she's a very reasonable and rational person who would have brought a lot to this program. However, because there is a lawsuit against the county now on this very issue, County Council advised Carrie Brown not to appear on this program, nor should any other supervisor, because it would expose him to questions in depositions that would probably be a part and parcel of the lawsuit, which I understand. But I'm hoping that anybody who feels strongly about this issue, particularly in favor of killing predators and wildlife, will feel free to call in at around 7:35, 7:40 at the latest. We will open up the lines. I'll invite some lively discussion here. So tonight we're going to be talking about the kinds of predator and livestock interactions that we see in Mendocino County, and I'd like to get into some discussion about what I personally view as a rather strange politics on the Board of Supervisors. Seldom do we see five supervisors agreeing upon an issue of political importance, and yet here the Board of Supervisors back in June, after public hearings, voted 5-0 to renew their contract with Wildlife Services, the federal agency, also to turn down the request that they order an environmental impact report to better understand the consequences of the killing of predators that's pretty rampant here in this county. With that said, I'm going to ask Kelly Hendricks and Dr. Hopkins to talk a little bit more about themselves and their interest here, and then we'll launch into a discussion.
Okay, you want me to start?
Please.
Like you said, I was a professional horse trainer, and I grew up a big animal lover, like a lot of girls, and especially horses, and worked for an equine vet, and then decided to go back to school to be a vet, but didn't have the grades, and so I ended up a horse trainer. I live on cattle ranch with my husband, Dean, in Petaluma, and he was running the cow-calf operation here for over 20 years, and with all this time around ranches and ranchers, that my family is a family of hunters and ranchers, and my dad is from Idaho, so my uncles are all still in Idaho, and one was a horse vet, one was a trapper, one was a rancher. So I grew up with a lot of that we see in those communities, which is a lot of the hatred of predators, and but I never felt that way, and I never understood it. And so when I quit training a few years ago, I got involved with Project Coyote because I really admired the work they were doing, and so then I got on their advisory board. Now, as you say, I'm their predator-friendly ranching coordinator, and yeah, I'm also working with Sonoma County Wildlife, rehabbing wildlife. So I think this program is a great avenue to. I think that the Wildlife Services is a really oblique organization. It's not well known, and it's taxpayer run, and so many people have never even heard of it. So it's always great to get the word out there and increase the knowledge about it.
Great. And Rick, would you tell the listeners a bit more about yourself, please?
Yeah. I've been involved, as you noted, with carnivores for nearly 40 years. I started in 1978 doing a research project in the hills above San Jose, the Mount Hamilton Range, studying cougars, where during a 12-year period of time from 1978 to 1990, I radio tagged some 30 individual cougars and determine their, you know, sort of behavior and social interactions and predation rates on their main prey deer. And as one can expect when you get involved in studying large carnivores, you get interested in human predator conflicts. And so essentially since that time, I've been quite engaged in working with a lot of different stakeholders and looking for solutions to predator conflicts and understanding what is perception and bias-based versus what's evidence-based and how one might meld a lot of those ideas together to come up with, you know, sort of useful creative solutions based on what we understand now to be the evidence. When I got involved in the late 1970s, it was really kind of the heyday of when people really started doing research on carnivores, and now there's been and really several decades worth of some really remarkable research and findings that have come out all over the world, but particularly in North America, about relationships and conflict prevention with carnivores. And so I like to see us move into the 21st century and how we integrate in the ideas that we now understand to be sort of evidence-based.
It seemed to me that there were at least two perspectives on this that we ought to be talking about. One are the ecological consequences of killing predators versus finding ways to keep them apart from livestock. And the other were the ethical issues of perhaps, on the one hand, animal rights. The predators were here before humans arrived, and predators were presumably here before ranching became fairly widespread in Mendocino County. Are you up for starting with the ecological consequences, and then maybe we can talk about your perspective on the ethics of predator so-called management? And I do want to say, I'm going to ask, I personally, the term lethal control to me is a little bit of a whitewashing. I tend to use the term predator killing. I think it's a more accurate description of lethal predator control. Are you all right for going that direction, or does that?
No, I think that's fine. I mean, it is what it is. So I'm fine with that term.
Great. Rick, shall we start with you on that, on the ecological consequences, big picture, and then maybe I'll ask Kelly to talk about her experiences on their ranch with predators and what they do with them.
Sure. Well, I think there's kind of two issues. One that is the presumption that the sort of the traditional approaches we've been engaged in of sort of prophylactic efforts to kill a variety of predators in with the notion that by doing so we will reduce conflicts with humans has been well understood not to be evidence-based. And I can take you back to the Starker-Leopold report back in 1964, which sort of criticized the ADCs, which was the previous version of Wildlife Services, in terms of a lot of the ineffectiveness of the program. It's the Kane report in 1970, which was even more excoriating in terms of its conclusion that the broad killing of predators had virtually no connection with reducing depredations. To quite a bit of research over the last decade to 15, or two decades, where we've found, you know, with wolves and cougars and coyotes, that these really significant broad-level killing of predators has not grown more game, if you will, or reduced conflicts with livestock. And there's considerable amount of evidence that have just come out recently in the scientific literature from Idaho and Washington and throughout the West that That's really an ineffective approach. And if we could really get back to what Kane and Leopold said, is we really should be focusing our efforts to reduce conflicts to the individual animals responsible for the conflict, not to the species as a whole. And then I'll build from that, and what's been sort of lost in this whole thing is this ethic that's been lost that Stark or Aldo Leopold really kind of started pushing, where he was really quite involved in pushing predator control very early in his career, and then later, you know, had sort of this epiphany that if we look at a land ethic and we look at conservation, as he was looking at, as he put it in Sand County Almanac, a wise tinker never throws anything away. And I think that's really kind of the broad perspective we need to realize, is that we now started realizing that not only is the broad predator control programs that are sort of pushed by wildlife services are ineffective and costly, it also forgets the fact that predators serve an important ecological role, and we're diminishing their importance by not recognizing, you know, a lot of the problems we have with mesocarnivores and rabbits and rodents and such is because of all of the war that we've put against a lot of other predators.
What's a mesocarnivore?
Skunks, raccoons, smaller carnivores, okay. Medium-sized carnivores. And so I think we've lost the fact that everything's connected. And it's sort of like if you get involved in any kind of physical therapy and you think your back hurts, you sometimes don't realize that pain might emanate because of some knee dysfunction. And so we forget that everything is connected, and if we try and micromanage one little segment without fully understanding the group, grasping the broader picture, we oftentimes screw up. And that's sort of what we've done the last 60 or so years with this crazy predator control approach that hasn't worked.
Let me reintroduce my guests a moment. You've just been hearing from Dr. Rick Hopkins, who is the senior conservation biologist at Live Oak Associates in the Bay Area. And you're about to hear from Kelly Hendricks, a rancher in the Petaluma area, who both of my guests are associated with Project Coyote. And Kelly, would you step in on this as how you view on the local scale of your ranch and in the North Coast, the impact of predator killing?
Well, I can tell you this. You know, I've worked on a lot of ranches and in a lot of situations with livestock and predators where they meet, and I've been on places where they do lethal controls or predator killing, and on our own ranch, which we don't, we have our cows calve in pastures with coyotes, and they'll come in and eat the afterbirth and leave, and we have few problems. And that's not to say we never have any problems, but I can say anecdotally, in my experiences, I have seen that in using, you know, by killing the predators, I've seen no better success at keeping livestock losses down than by not killing them. And I also feel that by not killing them, you know, these coyotes do us a huge favor by controlling our ground squirrel populations and the rabbits and everything else, which, you know, it keeps our pastures healthier. So we appreciate them for that. And, you know, if you're going to be in ranch, there's the old saying, if you're going to have livestock, you're going to have dead stock. And if you're going to be in ranching, there's going to be some losses, and it's always fascinating to me that we can lose, you know, a lot of livestock through other means, but when one's taken by a predator, it's taken very personally. And I just think that if you're going to ranch, there's going to be some loss, and like I said, we have had some losses from predators, but seeking revenge to me has never seemed like a very stable management practice. I don't understand revenge as a... I don't understand how causing more animal suffering fixes anything.
Go on. Sorry.
And so when something like that happens, it's usually... I've often found, almost always, that it's through some, you know, husbandry practice that we could do better. And I think it's always hard to admit, as a rancher, when you lose an animal, that you know, might have been responsible in some ways. But often that is the case. And you have to be able to deal with that fact to be able to prevent them in the future. So I just find that predators get a lot of blame for, in a lot of cases where they should be appreciated.
Do either of you see a sort of a generation gap in ranching? Do the older ranchers, the old-timers, whatever you want to call them, do their kids have similar attitudes, or do you see a change in the attitude towards predators on the part of ranchers in subsequent generations?
Yeah, I would say it is a little bit generational. I mean, not exclusively, but there's certainly that component to it. You do see that attitudes are changing, but with human nature being what it is, they change painfully slow. But they are changing, and I think, you know, that's a great thing. We're learning more, and we have more tools at our disposal, and we're getting more tools at our disposal for non-lethal livestock protection all the time. And to keep an open mind and an attitude that things can be done, that we can do a better job, I think is really important. And I think that's where Wildlife Services gets into problems, is their inability to say we can do better. You know, instead they take a defensive posture, which I think only hurts them and causes a lot of problems ultimately.
I'd like to come back to that a little later about the specifics of Wildlife Services.
Sure.
I think, Dr. Hopkins, do you think that there are times where it might be justifiable to kill an individual predator?
Yeah, I think so. I think the problem has become that is the first tool in the toolbox in all of these cases. And, in fact, it's been instituting these broad level of killings across, you know, different seasons and across broad areas, thinking that has some effect. But I do think that, you know, there are times where that might be the only solution available, and it's sort of case-by-case specific. I think the issue is that we need, as Kelly's suggesting, to sort of reset our expectations and our thoughts that there will be conflicts, And what are the most effective ways to deal with conflicts? And I know that Kelly and her work in Marin County, there have been ranchers there that have found that, oh, surprise, surprise, when they shifted from the more traditional killing everything in sight kind of approach to being a much more very case-by-case basis, the number of depredations went down quite a bit. And I think that, and so the cost, you know, when you think about it, the cost is also more efficient in that regard. And I think what Kelly is saying is that there's a tradition to how we think about things. We humans are traditional, and we humans like simple answers. We think that if I shoot something, it must make it better. If I make one less of a predator, I have a less of a problem. Well, the problem with natural systems is it's not that easy, and so relying on these sort of simplistic traditional approaches, and we're comfortable with it. Well, we just always have done it, so we'll just always continue doing it. But yet it's been shown to be not the most effective approach out there. But I think Kelly's right in that younger generations tend to be more interested in being creative and integrating new ideas. You know, you look at kids today picking up, you know, computers and phones and iPads, and, you know, when I was doing my research, computers were big, gigantic machines that, you know, we had to get special time on in order to use, and now everyone has several in their house and on their phone. I mean, my iPhone is probably far more powerful than any computer I used back in the 70s in some respect, and so I think there's the younger generation tends to be more geared towards change.
Is any of that rethinking a result of a different set of ethics about the relationships between animals and humans? Are you seeing any change on that front, or is it that people don't? In the cities, the youngsters don't have much exposure to wildlife to begin with.
Well, I think Kelly can speak more to the more rural communities, and I'll speak a little bit just more general as a scientist and what I'm seeing. I think there is a real difference in terms of how people view animals across the board. I mean, when we start realizing that, you know, the way animals were treated back 200 years ago is different than they're treated today, even within rural communities. And so I think that that change and that view, when you realize the way some wildlife are treated, here's something I always point out, is that the way that some people treat wildlife, if they were to treat a domestic animal that way, they would be arrested and convicted of animal abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the distinction that we have parsed out, that wild animals, it's okay to abuse them at some level. And some people do. Not all people who are hunters or whatever do that, but some do. Some are quite abusive to wild animals. And they're no different than your dog or cat when you think about it in terms of their personalities and their behaviors. I mean, you look at a cougar or a coyote, I mean, and you watch them for any length of time. They play. They have interesting interactions with each other. They're really quite fascinating creatures in that regard, if you just sort of separate the politics from it and look at the animal. And it's not different than if you look at, and they're all individuals. Individual coyotes act very differently with certain circumstances and with each other, as do individual dogs. And so they're not really any different in that regard. And I'll let Kelly again speak to the more rural community, because she has a much better sort of connection in that aspect.
Yeah, Kelly, if you would talk about particularly North Coast, Sonoma County, Mendocino County, I mean, Marin to some extent, but what are your thoughts in that regard?
Well, I will say this, that I think is a common misperception among the rural community that I often hear, is because my mom lived in Hollywood Hills, and she was very sick for a lot of years, and I spent a lot of time there taking care of her. And the common misperception among the rural community is that the people in that these laws and these new ethics are being passed by people that live in cities that have little contact with wildlife, and so it doesn't matter to them. In other words, these animals aren't causing them problems, so it's easy for them to say, oh, we want, you know, mountain lions and coyotes and blah blah blah. And the truth is, in Hollywood Hills, when I was in Hollywood, I saw more wildlife and higher densities than ever saw on any ranch. That they're living in closer proximity to more people. The wildlife there is just incredible. And a lot of these people in cities are living close to even big predators. There's mountain lions right in the same neighborhood where my mom lived. And so, there's some people in cities that are just like some of the rural people that aren't happy with it too. You know, they like the idea of these animals, but the minute their little kitten gets, you know, taken that they left outside, then they want them killed. So there's that hypocrisy too going on in the city. But it's I don't think it's a rural versus urban thing. I think it's a personal values thing. So, but I hear that often. From the rural community, that all these laws protecting animals are just from these people living in cities that don't know anything about animals. I mean, they may not know a lot about animals, but they're living next to them, I can guarantee you that. Mm-hmm. So, and as far as on the ranches, I think it's often overlooked how much value that predators bring and how much they do for the ranching community that is not considered. As far, they did a study in Utah where they thought that where they have wild bison, and they were competing with the cattle that were there for grazing. So they thought, the ranchers thought that the cattle or that the bison were eating, you know, were out competing their cattle for the forage. So they did a test, and it turned out that the bison were consuming 13% of the available forage, cattle were 33%, and the or 22%, and the rabbits were out-competing the bison, almost eating as much as the cattle because they had big bounties in place and it eliminated so many of the coyotes. So it shows you what can happen when predators are removed from an area. And
I'm going to interrupt you there just a moment, a short break for Mary Eigner to talk about the underwriters, and then we'll come back to the benefits that wildlife bring to Mendocino County.
You're tuned to the Ecology Hour here on KZYX with your guest host this evening, Don Lipmanson. And support for the Ecology Hour comes from the members of KZYX and the Solar Living Institute and the Real Good Store on Highway 101 in Hopland. Friends and family are invited to walk the new Lavender Labyrinth, see the Observation Beehive, enjoy a cup of hot cider, and talk with the knowledgeable staff. Inspiration, it happens every day at Real Goods from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Information at realgoods.com.
And to reintroduce my guest to anyone who has tuned in late, you've been hearing from Kelly Hendricks, who is a horse lover and rancher in the Petaluma area, and Dr. Rick Hopkins, who's an ecologist with a private consulting firm in the South Bay, I believe, right, Rick? Your firm.
Yes, that's correct.
And let's then jump right back into this question of how do each of you see the benefits that wildlife bring to a rural county like Mendocino? Dr. Hopkins, you want to start off with that?
Sure. I mean, I think, one, I believe that what is often missed is that as Starker Leopold and Aldo Leopold pushed the sort of the land ethic notion, is that all wildlife has intrinsic value. And so with that into context, I think that it's easy for me to understand that these large predators, you know, they play a role. They shaped predation is an important evolutionary process, and therefore what we see today is to a large degree shaped by things like competition and predation. And so how deer act, how rabbits and rodents act are all, you know, there's sort of these predator avoidance strategies they've developed and special mechanisms to avoid predators. At the same time, predators have an important role in terms of, as Kelly was mentioning, about, you know, issues with the rabbits, you know, in the Wyoming and such. And so we end up with predators having a role in terms of how they affect their prey populations, in terms of rodents and we forget about that, and rabbits. They do influence those, the distribution and the abundance over, you know, over time. And I think as an ecologist and a conservation biologist, I find it important to have fully functioning ecosystems in that regard. And so when we try and greatly reduce the number of a particular animal, sometimes we fail miserably at trying to do that because, like with coyotes, if we go in and we shoot a bunch of coyotes, we may not make fewer coyotes, but we've dramatically changed the social structure and the demographics. You end up with a lot younger, proportion of the population now tends to be much younger, and the social interactions are very different, and so we've modified and changed how that population of coyotes acts, as been shown in Washington, where they found that hunting cougars actually exacerbated the depredation level, that as hunting went up, the depredation level went up because there was the younger juvenile population that was generated by that increased hunting. Those were the animals that were most likely to be involved in killing livestock.
Isn't the same true for wolves and wolves in particular as well?
Yeah, there's actually been some research to show that looking at all the research in North America has shown that actually shooting and killing wolves is actually the number of wolves one kills the next year, their depredation incidences can go up both on cattle and sheep, and that you have to get to a level so high that you essentially are causing a dramatic decline in the wolf population, and then almost a near extirpation, and then, as all the researchers have found, that becomes short-lived, that once you release that pressure, you know, depredation will come back. And so there, as long as we're, and most of us would argue that we want to have a full complement of both predators and prey, and as long as we have livestock grazing on natural lands, there will be depredations, and there can be effective ways, as you know, Kelly can speak to in terms of Marin County, that one can minimize those. But one can never get them to zero, and we should never try to get them to zero, because it's not possible. There's a sort of diminished return. And so I think that we forget that predators, coyotes, for instance, can have a good effect on abundance of rabbits and small rodents, things that also affect farming. So there's all kinds of these interactions. As I said, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. You know, you start trying to play with just one little segment of nature, you cause all these unintended consequences that you hadn't intended for.
Kelly, on the scale of a ranch, of a 500-acre ranch, what are you seeing in the way of benefits by not killing predators?
Well, I could say this. We don't graze all our cattle here. With as many cattle as we have the lease land, too. But here on the ranch where we, on our, the property here, which is not our property, but we work for the ranch owners, we don't kill predators. And we don't, like I said, we don't see, I can't say we don't lose any livestock to attack, because it has happened. But to just react by blasting every coyote you see, as Rick said, it can cause unintended consequences that they may not have taken into account. And so we have stable coyote packs here. We want to keep them stable, because if we are to start shooting them up or trapping them or whatever, then juvenile coyotes are left without a social structure, and we know what happens when you leave kids without adult supervision. Those are the ones you're going to have to worry about attacking your livestock, and, you know, when they get desperate. And also, they're very territorial coyotes, and once you break up a system, a stable coyote pack, you've killed animals, and now just transient coyotes are going to move in. So it's just another problem that you're just creating. So it's funny to me that it takes so much convincing to that at this point, with all we've seen that we've done and all the past damage that we've done ecologically, that we still continually try to outsmart nature instead of learning to work with it. It's kind of fascinating that we're so slow to learn this. And like Rick said also, I believe what Rick said too, that sometimes there is going to be situations where lethal control is going to be necessary, because coyotes are like people in the sense that they're individuals, and occasionally you're going to get a bad actor, one that, you know, will cause trouble. But the percentage of those is so slight compared to the amount of killing we do of them that it's just ridiculous. We need to turn this up on its head and to really see some improvement in the way we're handling things right now.
Speaking,
because we're killing far, far, far too many predators that aren't causing us problems.
Speaking of which, there in Mendocino County and the North Coast in general, there is the problem of poisoning of wildlife, intentional or accidental, by marijuana growers. Do you have any? Do either of you have any thoughts on that, on the ethics of it, and what's to be done about that problem?
Well, unfortunately, in the last decade, we have learned, particularly with research next to urban areas with cougars and other predators, we've learned that the incredible use of rodenticides in this society and in these urban areas has created these secondary effects where a number of cougars and other predators, coyotes, that are eating these rodents that have been poisoned with rodenticides are suffering these secondary effects. It is dramatic. I mean, and when you're looking at stressed populations, in Southern California, they find that
448, that's 707-895-2448, or you can also email dj@kzyx.org.
And changing subjects, let's talk some about wildlife services. What's their problem? Why are they so hell-bent on sticking with traditional methods. I know there's talk about them using moving more towards no killing, but well, we have a call coming in, so let's hold that thought one moment and take this call, please. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Sherry.
Hi. Do you have a question or a comment for the guests?
Well, I wanted to comment about the marijuana growers using the animal, you know.
The poisons?
Pesticides, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's kind of crazy you pointed out marijuana growers. I think that maybe Taco Bell might kill more animals than a lot of marijuana growers, and I just thought it was kind of interesting that you brought those people up specifically.
Well, we're talking wildlife, Taco Bell, sure, they kill a lot of cow. They're responsible for...
the habitat that used to be forest, you know, is now a parking lot, you know? So I just, I think that's just as bad, you know, destroying habitat.
Well, it's a point that she makes that I agree with her on one thing, is that not only the pot growers, but, people are still using a lot of these pest control companies that in their homes that use a lot of these poisons, although, you know, we've taken a lot of the second generation ones off the market in California, but these pest control companies still use them, and probably 90% of the animals we get in these wildlife rescues show traces of these poisons in their system, and sometimes to toxic levels. And if people listening could do one thing that's pretty easy to save a lot of wildlife, it would be not to use poisons to kill rats and mice, because the unintended consequences are horrible.
Yeah, and I'm sure that, you know, most commercial agriculture uses lots of toxic poisons to fertilize and to kill the insects on their plants, too, and a lot of animals are exposed to just, you know, regular agriculture poisons as well.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true, but I think what we're pointing out is that large predators in particular, like down in Southern California where this was originally sort of detected in a population of a very stressed cougar population in the Santa Monica Mountains, is that the heavy use of rodenticides by the urban community around the Santa Monica Mountains is having these unintended consequences. People think they go into Home Depot or Lowe's or any other large a hardware store, and there's gigantic rows of just product after product of these anticoagulants that have these dramatic effects on wildlife. So whether it's marijuana growers or urban communities, they are killing wildlife by the use of these rodenticides. I mean, they're not intending to, but they are. And I think that's the concern that we have, that large predators occur, they're apex, you know, species, they occur in fairly low densities, and introducing these stresses that, you know, people don't think about are putting those populations at greater risk from all of the factors that, you know, squeeze upon them. And so I think it's important for us to look for alternatives of controlling rodents, not poisons.
Sherry, thank you for your call. I hope that answered your question to some extent. If anyone would like to call in and join this conversation, our on-air line is 707-895-2448. That's call us at 707-895-2448, and we'll be happy to hear your thoughts and your questions. While we're waiting for other calls, can we talk about the problem with Wildlife Services, the federal agency with which the county has chosen to contract in the past and now has unanimously, on the part of all the supervisors, decided to continue with the contract, a lethal killing program, rather than and not requiring any environmental impact report on the consequences of this contract. Would either of you like to address what you think is going on in Mendocino County specifically? Why do we have such a consensus on the part of the supervisors, a consensus that's very different from what I think happened down in Marin County, where non-lethal methods were prioritized? Kelly, you want to start with that?
Yeah, I think that obviously Marin County, being what it is, it has a very strong environmental ethic. that, and, you know, the citizens that live there are very environmentally aware and concerned. And as you get, you know, when you get to Sonoma, it's a little less so. You get to Mendocino, it's a little less so. So the politicians and the supervisors and people in charge there, I think a lot of them are, if there's a lot of people that are okay with the killing and using wildlife services, they don't want to go against that. And with, you know, the agribusinesses, the influence they wield in the hunting on political structures is enormous. So I think there's a lot of political pressure in more rural communities to keep things like wildlife services in place, whether they're needed or not. And it, as we know, it's fully run on taxpayers' dollars, and I think that there's a lot better ways we can utilize that money rather than killing millions of native wildlife every year.
I would just add in defense of local residents that there have been some very powerful environmental movements
right.
in this county in the 80s and 90s. I'm just astonished how little energy or even apparent interest I'm seeing for the supervisors to be able to vote unanimously just to maintain a status quo that goes against the ethics of an awful lot of people sort of suggests to me that we have a political problem. Now, I'm editorializing here, but
a lot of apathy too, you know, mm-hmm. of the people need to speak up if that's not what they want, and let their voices be known and show up to some of these meetings and get involved.
We have a call coming in. Good evening, caller. You're on the air.
I'm on the air now?
You are, yes. You are live.
There's somebody else on the air.
You need to turn your radio down, or actually turn it off. There's a delay that is probably sounding strange to you.
I can't get to the radio, but I would like to say that I think we need a new board of supervisors.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that, please?
If they are still for the killing of wildlife for no real reason, that needs to be dealt with. It's not okay.
Well, that's certainly a point of view that I think a fair number of people share, but it's not very much. I'm going to, of course, stay out of that one to some degree as the host here, but I can't help but notice a little bit, you know, what Kelly said there, that the amount of public attention to this is surprisingly little compared to the history of, like, vigorous environmental thought and protest here of the last few decades, where what's happening now, why is this not a matter of widespread concern? There were a number of people at that Board of Supervisors meeting who spoke out. I want to say at least as many who opposed the killing of wildlife as those from the ranching community who spoke in favor of it. But it doesn't seem to have an awful lot of traction. So I think for this to change, it's going to take more public expression, maybe some outrage, and certainly contacting the supervisors if you don't agree with the current policy and let them know that you don't and why. So is there anything else you'd like to add to this, caller?
Yes. It would be good if we had more information. I actually didn't know about this until I listened to you 10 minutes ago. And so, of course, I wasn't at any meetings. Also, I live on the coast and can't get to most meetings because most of them are inland. At
yes.
this time of year, the highways are not great. So
I think letters are, you know, emails are really important, and calls, too, can really make a difference. And it's exciting to know that this message is reaching people that didn't know about it. So that's good to know.
And at the end of this program, we'll give out some contact information.
That
caller.
Would be great.
Thank you. Thank you for your call. We have another call. Good evening, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. You know, Supervisor Hamburg, at least, was inundated with postcards from people in his district about the wildlife killing thing. And he obviously ignored us because we had rather a significant campaign going to make ourselves known. But he turned a deaf ear.
It also bears noting that there are a number of sheep ranchers in the 5th District, particularly in Anderson Valley. I don't know. I mean, I heard Ava Johnson, who's been here for decades and decades spoke rather forcefully and perhaps eloquently in favor of the continuation of the Wildlife Services contract. But the politics of it are somewhat mysterious to me, and I think they're worth people who want to change maybe need to ask their supervisors, well, why are you so adamant in support of Wildlife Services and opposed to having an environmental, at the very least, an environmental impact report to determine what the effect of the predator killing is?
Well, good question. Ava's son is the county trapper.
Interesting. Well, anything else you'd like to add to this?
No, only that, you know, it's just really sad that people who are so in favor of the killing haven't really looked carefully at the implications of getting rid of the wildlife. You know, yes, you can have a rogue coyote, but for every coyote killed, I read a really interesting book about coyotes on the East Coast, and when you kill the alpha, what happens is that the betas reproduce to a greater extent, and you end up with more coyotes.
Yeah, Rick, I think, is very knowledgeable about this. Rick, do you want to talk a little bit about that and then also talk a little bit about Wildlife Services approach and maybe, one might say, bias in favor of lethal of killing?
Okay, I'll take the rest off the air.
Thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, I think the caller, you know, makes a really good point, is that the simple approach that we have in terms of killing things, we just naturally assume that if I kill something, I've got one less or five less, and it's not that simple. And unfortunately, nature is complicated. And so you have changes, or you can have changes in litter sizes and pup survival, and you have and you also end up with probably more detrimental to sheep ranches is you end up with a disrupted social structure of a healthy, stable population of coyotes is going to behave very differently around sheep than if you have one that is constantly being disruptive with consistent killing and with younger and younger average age of the population. And so we don't realize that there can be, and I think Kelly has been sort of, as she admitted, you know, Marin County has had sort of a different strategy in terms of looking at these kinds of issues over the long term, but it doesn't belie the fact that it's been effective. You know, just because they've had a stronger, pre-adapted to look at change doesn't mean that what they've done has not been effective. It's been remarkably effective. And so that's the issue that people have to get over is somebody goes, oh, I don't want to do that. You know, it'll make me I'll be like Marin County. But I'm a pragmatist. You know, I don't worry about sort of these political situations. If you know, I run a business, and my attitude is, if I can find a way to reduce costs and increase revenue, that's how you run a business. I mean, those are sort of a simple way of looking at the business, but still, nonetheless, I worry less about the politics of things and more about what's most effective. Where can I spend the least amount of money and be more effective at reducing my losses while increasing my revenues? And Kelly sits in a place that's figured it out, you know, and it's not perfect. It's not going to be, you know, a cookie cutter that it goes every place exactly the same way. Each place is going to have to kind of grapple with it and make some changes and figure things out. But again, it's more effective. And you ask about Wildlife Services, which is sort of the problem behind all of this is tradition. And Wildlife Services is really good at convincing ranchers we don't need to change. And the sad thing is Wildlife Services does do some research on non lethal approaches. But that stuff, you know, while they tout it and all of that, and you'll hear them talk about it, it never really gets into the field. I mean, if they would talk about creating a completely different business model, I mean, the world has changed. I don't care. People got to get over the fact the world has changed, and you've got to think about how do you change as a business with it. I think about that every day running my own business. How do I stay and do things differently than what I did 15 years ago? If I operated like I did 15 years ago, I'd be working at Starbucks.
On that note, we have to wrap it up because we're coming close to the end of the hour. May I ask each of you to give out some information about how interested listeners might get in touch with you for more information?
They can contact Project Coyote for more information about this, or I'm happy to reply to messages at darbyhendricks@yahoo.com. They can email me direct or through Project Coyote, either way.
Okay, great. Thank you. And they can find Project Coyote online.
Yeah, projectcoyote.org.
Great. Rick, how can...
And also, I'm a connector with Project Coyote, but also I'm president of the board of the Cougar Fund based in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and which is a nonprofit organization based on science-based and education about cougars throughout the West. And also my business, if people want to get a hold of me at my email, they can email me at rhopkins@loainc.com.
Great. Well, thank you both very much. Appreciate your having taken the time to come on, and we'll stay in touch on this.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
In the last 2 minutes, I'd like to take just a moment to acknowledge a few people. First of all, listeners probably know this, but Mary Eigner, who served more than 20 years as program director here at KZYX, who's endured a lot of storms and conflicts over the years and somehow kept interesting programming going for several decades, is going to move on into, I think, with something less conflictual. And anyhow, wish her well. I'd also like to take just a moment to remember three important environmental activists who are no longer with us. They've passed away: Zach Zachary, Howie Seidel, and Gary Ball. We think of you. And lastly, I'd like to wish a strength and renewed health to a great friend of KZYX, Deborah Scott, aka Waterbird. Deborah, hope you will get through this, and your struggle has been admirable. It's been great talking to you listeners. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I would encourage you to get involved. As one of the listeners pointed out, nothing is going to change without your involvement and your engagement in what is fundamentally a political process around this issue of predator versus prey. And thank you for having stuck with this program.
Human beings are apparently hardwired to remember things that surprise us. Well, that's led to establishing surprise clinics, where people in the service industry learn about creating positive surprises for their customers. But how does this translate to cultures where people typically aren't encouraged to deviate from the normal way of doing things?